Coal mining helped fuel Pennsylvania's Industrial Revolution, but all those old mines are causing big problems for people who live here now.
We have people that live in close proximity to the dump. One house, I believe, is within 100 feet, the closest one. People have had to suffer with this.
I'm Reed Frazier. This week on the Allegheny Front, the Trump administration comes to Pennsylvania to talk about cleaning up abandoned mines. And some landowners say the gas industry isn't paying them their fair share of gas royalties.
It's thievery, no doubt about it.
Also, are you ready for another invasive species? It's got a cute name, but it's not so cute up close.
That's the daycare center who couldn't let the kids out because these things are flying all over the place.
All those and more environmental stories when our show continues. Stay with us. Pennsylvania's shale gas boom has helped bolster one sector of the fossil fuel industry, but it's also caused the decline of another, coal. An energy researcher discussed what this transition means for climate change during a recent visit to the University of Pittsburgh. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk reports.
Burning natural gas for electricity emits less carbon dioxide than burning coal. That should cut back on global warming, right? Daniel Ramey with the think tank Resources for the Future says yes, but only in the short term. Over the next few decades, other factors will come into play, making the transition to gas essentially a wash. That analysis is part of Ramey's new book on the fracking debate.
Natural gas competes with coal, but it also competes with renewables like wind and solar. It competes with existing nuclear plants. And low-cost energy in the form of natural gas and oil encourages people to use more energy. And when people use more energy, the emissions also rise.
He says it would take new policies like a carbon tax or greater investment in energy technology research to tilt the scale toward curbing global warming as shale development continues. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And if you want to hear more on the issue of shale development, Amy Sisk and I will be on a panel this month at the University of Pittsburgh to discuss another new book on the topic. It's called The Shale Dilemma by Shanti Gomper Rabindran. That's March 21st. For more information, including registration, go to our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Before he was elected, President Donald Trump promised to do a 180 on environmental regulations when he took office. It's been about a year since he did take office, so for our Trump on Earth podcast, we wanted to know, what has the Trump administration done on the environment in the last year? To answer that question, I spoke with Dan Farber. He's an environmental law professor at the University of California at Berkeley, where he's the co-director of the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment. He also blogs about those issues at legalplanet.org. So you wrote an overview of Trump's first year, and we'll link to that on our website. You know, you study these issues very closely. What have you seen out of the Trump administration after 1 year?
You know, to take your metaphor of doing the 180 on environmental policy, I think what I would say is that Trump has turned the car around, but he hasn't gone very far down the road in the opposite direction. He's got a lot of plans. There are a lot of proposals in the work. The stuff that's actually been sort of concrete accomplishments is a lot more limited. But of course, it's only the first year.
Sort of the chief prosecutor of Trump's plans in the environment is Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA.
You know, when you think about the EPA over the last several years before the president arrived, it was an agency that was weaponized. It was weaponized against certain sectors of our economy. So what we've spent the time doing this past year is de-weaponizing.
A lot of people have said that he's sort of a very sort of effective EPA administrator. He was called by Newsweek magazine the most dangerous member of the Trump cabinet because he's, you know, basically quietly gone about trying to dismantle so many, Obama-era policies on the environment. What have you seen out of Scott Pruitt?
Well, Pruitt is an interesting case. He certainly has put a lot of things in motion. He's issued a lot of rulemaking proposals to undo some major accomplishments from the Obama administration. He's delayed putting a lot of other things into effect. He's really, I think, as a organizational leader, he's really done his best to shrink EPA and to get rid of some of the longtime career people there. But so far, none of these things have really, or very few of them, have actually gotten to the point of being finalized actions that will then go to court. So what we have now is a lot of energy building and a lot of different things underway, but we'll have to see during this next year just what happens when these things finally come out of the agency as completed actions, and then we'll have to see what happens in court.
The first year you wrote was sort of, there was a lot of announcements, a lot of, you know, reversals of rules or putting rules on hold. Where are we at this year? Is there a lot of kind of now this stuff starts to get worked out through the legal process?
I should explain, in getting rid of a rule, it's actually a complicated process, just like creating the rule in the first place. You can't just wave a magic wand and the rule goes away. So what they've done is started the process by putting some proposals out there to eliminate existing rules. But now they have to go through the gathering of comments. They have to write up a pretty detailed, lengthy explanation of exactly why they're doing what they're doing. For some of the most important rules, like the wetlands rule, called the Waters of the United States rule, and the Clean Power Plan, which is the big climate change rule, I know that they're planning to issue the final rules this year. And it's at that point that we'll see the action turn to the courts, because state governments and environmental groups are going to immediately, probably within the first hour after these rules come out, they will file in federal courts to challenge the rules. And at that point, it's going to, you know, we'll have to see over what could be a period of another year what the courts actually have to say about these actions.
You know, you mentioned Trump's turned the car around, but he hasn't gone very far. What are some areas where he actually has made changes in environmental policy where people are going to see some effects or maybe not see actions taken?
Well, there are a couple of things. First, in EPA, one of the things that we're going to see is just less going on, right? I mean, there's clearly are not going to be any new regulations. They're trying to do their best to put existing regulations on hold. I think the area where we've actually seen the most real change is actually not at EPA, but at the Interior Department under Ryan Zinke. Zinke actually, with some assistance from the powers that Trump himself has over these areas, has done a lot to cut back on the size of some national monuments, authorize drilling and coal leasing in places where they weren't previously being allowed, and so forth. And so I think although he's gotten somewhat less attention than Pruitt, and although what Pruitt is planning to do may be more momentous in the long run, I think the early concrete actions from the administration have tended to have more to do with public lands than they have had to do with EPA's pollution-related mission.
I want to ask you, because you wrote about it a little bit, there's arisen in response to Trump this sort of Trump resistance on the left and in the Democratic Party. What have we seen on the environmental front in terms of a sort of a counter-reaction to Trump? What are some of the major developments
there?
Well,
besides the fact that Trump is being sued at just about every turn, I would point to a couple of things. One of the things that was really interesting right after the election was there was a huge surge in donations and membership for organizations like the Sierra Club that has really put them in a much better position to fight back against Trump. But the other thing that's happened that I I think is very encouraging. Actually, I try to focus on this as much as possible so I don't get too depressed, is that the states have really stepped up in a lot of ways. California has really strengthened its climate change program. State of New York has done that. We're seeing a number of other states where they're really pushing forward, I think partly in reaction to Trump. It's not, they might have done these things anyway, but I think that the idea that they can do this and kind of push back against Trump makes some of these things extra appealing. And that's one reason why the midterm elections are so important and the state elections are so important, because if the Democrats strengthen their hand in other states, we will see even more of this kind of state-based action trying to protect the environment despite the Trump administration. In fact, we've already seen that in New Jersey just from the 2017 governor's race, where New Jersey, under the new governor, has immediately taken some pro-environmental actions.
Right. It's almost like reverse, the opposite of, the typical argument in favor of states' rights is, usually those people who argue that states should have the lion's share of decision-making are conservatives. but here, states' rights are being used to put forward a sort of left, liberal, pro-environment kind of
Absolutely.
Agenda.
Now, of course, the limitation is it's only it's only a coalition of the willing. So unlike the federal government, state governments can't force other states to do things. I think a lot of people are feeling enthusiasm about federalism that they didn't used to feel. You also see that in the immigration area, right, where, we see sanctuary cities, sanctuary universities, et cetera, which are also efforts to kind of use states' rights for progressive ends.
Dan Farber is an environmental law professor at the University of California at Berkeley. There's more of our discussion at TrumpOnEarth.org. That's where you'll find all the episodes of the Trump on Earth podcast. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier. One of Trump's top environmental cabinet members is Ryan Zinke, Secretary of the Interior. Zinke came to Western Pennsylvania recently to talk about the problem of old coal mines. Zinke oversees the federal agency in charge of cleaning up these sites. And the town he came to, East Bethlehem Township, is home to one of these eyesores. Black Dog Hollow is a 100-foot-tall pile of coal and rock, an ugly hill created by the unwanted cuttings from a mine that closed 30 years ago. Nothing grows on it. It's eroding into nearby streams, and acid runoff pours off of it every time it rains. At a crowded fire hall just down a hill from the pile, Marianne Kabaki said it's generally a nuisance.
We have ATVs riding there, a lot of trespassing. Of course, it's unsecured, many entrances and exits to the dump. So we've had a lot of complaints about that, and we have had people get hurt there.
Kabaki is the secretary of East Bethlehem Township in Washington County. She was awaiting the arrival of Ryan Zinke, Secretary of the Interior. Zinke had chosen her town as the place to announce this year's abandoned mine funding because East Bethlehem is a poster child for why the program exists. Created in 1977, the Abandoned Mine Lands Fund helps states deal with the legacy of historic coal mining. With funding from the program, Black Dog Hollow is slated to get cleaned up in the next few years, which will come as a relief to Kabaki and the rest of the community.
We have, of course, the eroding channels, the water that fills our storm drains eventually ends up in our river. We have people that live in close proximity to the dump. One house, I believe, is within 100 feet, the closest one. People have had to suffer with this for many years, so we're glad to see something happening with it.
After arriving at the fire hall, Zinke came to the microphone. A tall Montanan and former Navy SEAL, Zinke said Pennsylvania was still ripe for coal mining.
And here, there's economic opportunity, and we can do it right. But we also have to learn from the past.
That was a past before modern regulations prevented companies from leaving scars on the land like Black Dog Hollow. With federal abandoned mine funding, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection will grade the site and treat the acidic topsoil so that plants will grow on it.
I think in probably between 12 months and 18 months, we're going to see grass in the hill. And in 5 years, we'll see trees. And compared to what it is today, to what it will be, that's in a positive direction.
Zinke revealed the amount for this year's cleanup program, $300 million. And he even signed one of those symbolic oversized checks.
It's only as good as the government.
Of that $300 million, Pennsylvania's share will be $55 million, second only to Wyoming. It's an increase over what the state has gotten over the past few years, thanks to a change in funding set out by Congress in 2006, when it reauthorized the program. The state's share is so big because it has so many old mine sites, 800, the most in the country. John Stefanko of the Pennsylvania DEP said that all told, the state's abandoned mines would cost $15 billion to clean up. At current funding levels, that work will go on for decades.
It's really hard to how to predict, but it definitely will not be in my lifetime and probably not your lifetime either.
The DEP has yet to determine when it will begin construction on Black Dog Hollow. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier. Coming up, there's a new pest in Pennsylvania, and it could pose problems for lots of people.
It's, you know, mom and dad that were planning on a family reunion that's had to cancel because the sooty mold is such a mess at their house.
Later on the Allegheny Front, what is this new pest? Stay tuned to find out.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University, now celebrating 25 years of preparing environmental professionals. The center provides multidisciplinary education for careers in environmental science and management with opportunities for research and internships. Programs include a BS in Environmental Science, Master's in Environmental Science and Management, and professional certificate programs. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
Royalty money from natural gas drilling has pumped billions of dollars into Pennsylvania's economy. It helped save many struggling family farms, just as the Great Recession was beginning in 2008. A decade later, the gas and the money are still flowing. But many people now say this economic windfall is being doled out in an unfair and possibly illegal manner. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more.
Charlie Clark says he's grateful every single day for the two gas wells that were drilled on his dairy farm. He estimates on average he receives about $10,000 per month in gas royalties.
This is what we've done with our gas money was this, you know, this barn here costs $40,000 to build it, you know, and we were able to build it out of our pocket.
Growing up in rural Susquehanna County, the northeastern corner of Pennsylvania, his family used to scrimp and save just to buy basics like new shoes. But all that changed when the gas rigs rolled into town. This is how royalties work. Gas companies and landowners typically sign a lease agreement before drilling begins. The royalty is money paid to the mineral owner, like Clark, for the right to use his resource. It's negotiated to be a certain percentage of the proceeds from the sale of the gas.
Homes, we're living like we used to, but without the stress. The bills are all paid. You know that, you know, the kids got to go to college. No problem. You go to college.
Clark is leased to a company called Chief Oil and Gas. Although he says he feels like he hit the lottery, he's acutely aware other people with similar gas wells are striking out.
And I thank God every day that it happened here and that I didn't live over there 10 more miles or 15 more miles that way to the west.
Jim Barrett lives about 40 miles to the west in Bradford County. He hops in his pickup to give a tour.
Oh, well, I think we're pretty typical mountain farm.
Like Clark, he's grateful for the drillers.
It kept Bedford County alive. This would have been a ghost town in 2008 or 2010 if it hadn't have been for the gas industry.
Barrett's got four wells on his land, operated by a company called Chesapeake Energy. He says Chesapeake is stealing from him, and he's joined a class action lawsuit against the company. Chesapeake is defending itself against lawsuits in at least seven states for allegedly underpaying royalties.
There's good farmers and there's bad farmers, and there's good gas companies and there's bad gas companies.
He estimates Chesapeake owes him hundreds of thousands of dollars for the gas it's pumped out of his farm.
It's thievery, no doubt about it.
A lot of the controversy over royalty money comes down to something called post-production costs. These are the expenses of moving gas through a network of pipelines. To cover these costs, drillers might take deductions from royalty checks. Some landowners agree to this in their leases, others don't. Gary Presler with the National Association of Royalty Owners explains.
The turning point was during the period of declining prices.
That began in 2014, when the United States was producing so much oil and gas that it led to a global oversupply. Many energy-producing states took a hit, like North Dakota, where Presler lives. There, pump jacks bob up and down, pulling up oil and a small amount of gas. Oil suddenly wasn't worth what it used to be, and the gas still needed to be transported and processed. That cost stayed constant.
And that's when people saw their checks being reduced significantly. Even though those deductions may have been taken previously, they just totally disregarded it because it, to them, it seemed like just a small and minimal amount.
In Pennsylvania, where wells mainly produce gas, landowners like Barrett noticed right away if companies took out big, unexplained cuts. Others never had a reason to complain, like Clark, who feels the deductions he gets are reasonable. Jerry Simmons heads the Royalty Owners Association. He says all this complexity surrounding royalties is uniquely American.
Basically, this is the only country on the planet where individuals actually own the mineral interest. It's everywhere else it's owned by the government.
As a result, millions of American landowners hold individual leases. Over the years, some sued when they felt they were being cheated. This has led to a patchwork of court rulings in many states determining how leases are interpreted. Given that, some landowners hire a lawyer to negotiate a lease with really specific language that prohibits deductions or spells out exactly which costs can be taken out. But law professor Owen Anderson with the University of Texas says not all of them go that route.
As often happens, these landowners and mineral owners sign these leases that the company offers without negotiating the terms and without getting legal advice.
Their options are then slim. They can hire an expert to audit their royalties and go to court, but some can't afford to do that. Presler with the Royalty Owners Association says the better option is to prevent landowners from signing bad leases.
Because it's a lot easier to try to get the terms correctly done at the front end than trying to manage and fix a problem later.
His group is developing a seminar to better educate landowners. Advocates in Pennsylvania are going a step further. For years, they've been pushing for legislation to ensure mineral owners get at least a 12.5% royalty. That's already the legally required minimum rate. Back on his farm in Susquehanna County, Charlie Clark says even though he won the lottery with gas royalties, he thinks the law should ensure everyone is paid fairly.
I guess I really don't understand why the government hasn't stepped in and done just a little bit more, because I think it would benefit them too. You know, any extra money that we would get, we would be taxed on.
And over in Bradford County, Jim Barrett says he and his wife would have to sell their farm to retire. But he wants to be able to pass it on to his grandkids.
My dad and his uncles, their goal was to keep the farm going for their sons. The same thing that my grandfather said and the same thing that my great-grandfather said.
Although Barrett's hopeful things will change, like many mineral owners across the country, he knows one thing. There's not much more he can do about it. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
From royalties to a royal pain, federal and state agencies are spending millions of dollars to fight a new insect pest in Pennsylvania. Here's the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant with more.
In the summer of 2014, a Pennsylvania Game Commission officer spotted a bug he'd never seen before in Berks County. It was about an inch long with dark spots and red hind wings. He called it into the state.
And lo and behold, it became our first discovery of spotted lanternfly in the northern hemisphere, quite frankly, not just Pennsylvania, but in all of North America.
That's Fred Strathmeyer of the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, whose job now centers on controlling lanternflies. Within a month of that first report, the state issued a quarantine. But this is a fast-breeding, fast-spreading insect, not because it can fly so quickly, but its dirt-like egg masses are known to hitchhike on trucks, trains, and ships, which is how these Asian bugs are believed to have gotten here. And Strathmeyer says there's a lot at stake. While the main food source is an invasive known as ailanthus, or tree of heaven, lanternflies also suck sap from more than 70 other plant species, including important Pennsylvania crops like grapes, hops, and hardwood trees.
The state of Pennsylvania is the leading state in the nation for hardwoods. It's an $18 to $20 billion industry to this state, so you can only imagine the impact. You can imagine the impact for the grape industry if it were to end up in Erie.
13 southeastern Pennsylvania counties are now under quarantine. Spotted lanternflies also have recently been found in New York, Delaware, and Virginia. In early February, Governor Tom Wolf proposed spending $1.6 million, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture committed more than $17 million in new emergency funding to stem further spread. In this video by the Penn State Entomology Department, you can watch a swarm of them gnaw and suck on a grape plant. They excrete a stream of something called honeydew, which leads to a sooty mold. It's already reduced grape yields and damaged hops and walnut trees. Strathmeyer says it's also making some parts of southeastern Pennsylvania unpleasant in the summer.
That's the daycare center who couldn't let the kids out because these things are flying all over the place. It's, you know, mom and dad that were planning on a family reunion that had to cancel because the sooty mold is such a mess at their house.
With the new infusion of funding, Pennsylvania agriculture officials are meeting with the USDA. They're looking at programs to stop the lanternfly's spread, including increased surveillance and expanding the use of herbicides on those ailanthus trees that lanternflies love so much. But Strathmeyer says that still won't be enough.
We realize that you're not going to be able to contain and or herbicide every ailanthus tree in this state. It's an impossible task. So our next best thing is to make sure that people are aware of it.
Agriculture officials ask people who see lanternflies, their egg masses, or full-grown insects, to double bag them, throw them away, and report it to the state. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Yeah, sooty mold, not so cute. That's our show. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. As always, go to our website for more on the stories you hear on our show, AlleghenyFront.org. And subscribe to the Trump on Earth podcast so you don't miss a single episode. That's at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Reed Frazier. Kara Holsoppel will be back next week. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Katherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.